Choir, beautifully done. Thank you very much. Well, here we are, and now we begin the season of Lent. We celebrate it in a number of different ways. For one thing, liturgically, this is a high and holy season, so clergy wear robes and the traditional color of purple. The music changes somewhat. We have the Wednesday night services, and we invite people into 40 days, 40 nights of some kind of spiritual practice that will bring you closer to God. We also start our preaching of the season of Lent with the traditional story. It's told by Matthew, Mark, and Luke. All three of them tell the story about Jesus being in the wilderness. I've decided to preach this year from Mark. I love Mark. He's brief, and this particular story is told almost like poetry rather than like prose. We'll talk about Matthew and Luke in a moment. We're going to read this and leave it up there because this is a story that you have to really read the context before you fully understand it. You'll see it happens quickly in Mark, the first chapter, verses 12 through 13. At once the Spirit, and we're talking here about the Spirit of God, at once the Spirit sent him, Jesus, out into the wilderness, and he was in the wilderness 40 days, being tempted by Satan. Please listen to what they're saying. The Spirit of God sent him into the wilderness for 40 days to be tempted by the devil. He was with the wild animals, and the angels attended him. Just those two verses, remarkable verses from Mark. I want to read for you what comes right before then, because this is one of the starkest transitions you'll ever read in the Bible, or really in any kind of literature. Right before then, Jesus has come upon John the Baptist. John the Baptist is baptizing people, and Jesus says, I must be baptized. So this is what happens right before then. In those days, Jesus came from Nazareth of Galilee and was baptized by John in the Jordan. And just as he was coming up out of the water, he saw the heavens torn apart and the Spirit descending like a dove upon him. And a voice came from heaven saying, you are my Son, the Beloved. With you I am well pleased. And then the transition to our text. And the Spirit, that same Spirit of God, immediately drove him into the wilderness for 40 days and 40 nights. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. This is what Coach Lambert said on the first day of basketball practice my freshman year in high school. He gathered us around and he said, boys, by the end of the week, you're either going to be in shape or you're going to be in a heck of a shape, one or the other. As I recall, he used a little bit more colorful language than that, but just like we translate from Greek for the Bible, I thought that would be the best way to explain what he said in the sanctuary. And he was right. By the end of the week, all we had done was run up and down, up and down, up and down that basketball court. And after 5 days of that, we were in pretty good shape, but we also were in terrible shape. Some of you remember, we had blisters on our feet that were bleeding. It's interesting, as we got to basketball practice that first day, all we really wanted to do was play basketball. We wanted to dribble, pass, shoot, score, play basketball. We wanted to be a team. But we learned the hard way that before you get to be a team, before you get to play basketball for Denison High School, you have to go through a period of testing and preparation. You have to prove that you're worthy of the job of representing Denison High School, and you have to get into shape so that you will do it well. You have to be prepared. I wonder if that's the way Jesus felt at his baptism. He's walking along there and he comes upon John the Baptist. And John the Baptist is preaching the kingdom of God to all these people. He's saying you must be baptized. And Jesus comes up to John. John doesn't feel like he needs to baptize Jesus. But Jesus says, yes, let it be done unto me like everybody else. And so Jesus is baptized. John the Baptist, his cousin, dips him into the waters of the River Jordan. And Jesus comes up out of the waters. The water's dripping from him, from his hair. You can see this. And as he does so, the skies open. It's a private revelation. If you read carefully, it's pretty clear that not everybody saw and heard this, only Jesus. But the skies open. And with the waters, the baptismal waters falling from him, there is a voice from God that says, "You are my beloved, with you I am well pleased." And surely that was the moment when Jesus knew that who he was, who he thought he was perhaps, maybe he had had an inkling, maybe he had always known, I don't know, but surely it was confirmation for him of who he was, the Messiah, the Son of God, the one who proclaimed the kingdom of God. And neither Matthew, Mark, or Luke, any of them give us any understanding of what's taking place in the mind of Jesus at that moment. But I would think that with him standing there freshly baptized, the Spirit of God descending upon him, that he was thinking, yes, now I know what I'm supposed to do. Now I'm supposed to go out and do what I've been called to do, to preach and teach and to work some miracles and to proclaim the kingdom of God, to bring people closer to God. And maybe he's thinking about this. He can't wait to get to ministry. And all of a sudden, just like that, the Spirit of God drives him into the wilderness. I think that's an interesting word. Not all the translations put it that way, but I think the better ones do. The Spirit of God drove him into the wilderness. It wasn't something he really wanted to do. It was something that God was requiring of him. Now, this is such an important text that we read every year at the beginning of Lent from Matthew, Luke, or Mark. These are called the three synoptic gospels because they share a lot of material together. Matthew, Mark, and Luke all have material and stories that are unique to them, but they also have this body of material that they share together. And so Mark was the first one written. So when Matthew and Luke sat down to write their gospels, they had Mark in front of them. It's like they're going to write a biography, but they had an earlier biography in front of them. So they had the story in front of them. But this was must have been a widely known story and an important story because they add a lot of material that Mark did not have. So the accounts of Luke and Matthew are very, very similar. They take the two verses of Mark and they stretch it into a pretty long section of prose in which they tell three stories about what happened to Jesus when he was in the wilderness for 40 days and 40 nights. The first story is about Satan coming to Jesus, and there's a big stone there, and Satan tempts Jesus. He says, "Take this stone and turn it into bread." And Jesus refuses to do it. He says, "You shall not tempt the Lord your God." Matthew and Luke both tell that story. I've always thought that maybe that was the greatest temptation of all. I was still in high school when I read Dostoevsky's The Brother Karamazov. It was a way too difficult book for me to read at that time. I don't really remember too much of it, but I still remember the section on the Grand Inquisitor, where the Grand Inquisitor is interrogating Jesus, and he just pursues this line of questioning relentlessly. He says, "Why didn't you turn stone into bread? That's what people want. Had you done so, everybody would have followed you." And I think about what a temptation that is, because I think about what a temptation it would be for us in this church. So much of our ministry to others, serving God, serving others, transforming lives, is about feeding other people, not just with bread, but giving other people social skills and all sorts of help so that they can live full and meaningful and purposeful lives. If God gave us the opportunity to turn stone into bread, I think we would. How could we not? Jesus understood it to be a temptation. Do not tempt the Lord your God. The second temptation was Satan taking Jesus to Jerusalem and saying, "There's the temple. You see the pinnacle of the temple, climb up there and jump off. Because you know that God will save you." It says so in the Psalms. The angels of God will come and lift you and bring you gently to the ground. And Jesus refused the temptation. The third temptation, the most blatant of all, Satan took Jesus to the top of a great mountain, and he said, "Look around you, Jesus, 360 degrees, all the kingdoms of the world God has given me those kingdoms, and I'll give them to you if you'll bow down and worship me. And Jesus refuses. Jesus refuses. So we understand, I think, what is going on here, don't we? All of these temptations from Satan to Jesus, all of these are temptations to be like God rather than like a human being. In every one of these temptations, we see that Satan is tempting Jesus to act like God, to embrace his divinity, rather than to, the way it's, Paul puts it in Philippians, rather than emptying himself of divinity and fully claiming his humanity. And so we know that when Jesus rejects all of these temptations, had he taken any one of them, it would have changed the story. To you, I'll give all the kingdoms of the world. Had Jesus taken that bet from Satan, it would have changed the story dramatically. We would come here on Palm Sunday and we would read the story about Jesus coming down Main Street in Jerusalem, and he wouldn't be riding a donkey, he'd be riding a stallion. Right? And James and John, who had been rebuked earlier for asking this, they indeed would be sitting on the right and left hand of Jesus, and Jesus would be sitting on a throne. What a temptation that must have been. And yet Jesus somehow understood that what God intended for him was contained in the promise of Matthew. He will be with us. He will be a human being. The promise of incarnation, he will become fully human. And by becoming fully human, he will experience and suffer everything on earth that every one of us experiences, including suffering and pain and death, death even unto a cross. It was Jesus embracing his humanity, fully human. And I wonder what that means for us, because I think in so many ways, for you and me, our spiritual journey is trying to avoid as much suffering and pain as we possibly can. I mean, one way of practicing your faith is asking God to spare you of any suffering or pain. We all do this, don't we? And there are people who bargain with God, I'll keep all the commandments, I'll do everything you ask me to do, I will be in church and Sunday school every single day, I will tithe, if only I can avoid the suffering and pain that I see in others around me. I mean, on the one hand, that's not a bad strategy. We are all tempted by that, aren't we? It's not a bad strategy, it's just that we know that if that's your strategy, someday you're going to lose your faith. Right? Someday you're going to lose your faith, because none of us get to avoid the journey through the wilderness. We talk around here all the time about the spiritual journey. And I think a lot of times we think, I do, I certainly think of the spiritual journey as a sweet, sweet journey, one in which we grow closer to God. And indeed, it is that. It is that. But today we're forced to ask the question, can the spiritual journey be much more than that? Much more frightening than that? Can the spiritual journey sometimes take us to the brink, to that point in life where we're ready to give up? Are ready to reject God? Is it possible that sometimes the spiritual journey takes us to the place where the suffering and pain feels almost unbearable? What does it mean if that's what constitutes a spiritual journey? Because I think that's what Mark tells us in this story. It's Jesus embracing his humanity, including the suffering and the pain and the death. This past week I was in Sherman, Texas. I was up in Whitesboro, Texas, and I went over to see a friend of mine who's the pastor of First Methodist Church in Sherman. I drove on the old Highway 56, the old 82, the old road running west to east to Sherman. It'd been a long time since I'd been on that road going into Sherman. When I was in my early 20s, I served First Methodist Church Sherman as an associate. I was a youth director. And so I drove into Sherman. It wasn't far. But as I got to the Highway 75 and Sherman, I'd forgotten that it was there. I passed the old cemetery. And the memories started flooding back. I was only 23, maybe 24 years old, and I loved what I was doing. I was an associate at First Methodist Sherman. For the most part, I was a youth director. I did youth work. I loved doing youth work. I worked for a great pastor by the name of Dr. Earl Hoggard. And that's all I wanted to do. I didn't want to preach. I didn't want to do anything but youth work. And I'll never forget that day. It was a Monday morning of Holy Week. And I was shaving. And the phone rang, and I went to the phone, and it was Dr. Hoggard. And he said, "Don, my elderly mother in Oklahoma just passed away unexpectedly." He said, I need to go up there and make arrangements and have a service. But he said, "Don't worry, I'll be back for Wednesday, and I'll be back to preach Easter services. But in between now and then, you've got it. You're the senior minister." I said, "No problems, Dr. Hoggard, no problems at all. I got it." I was so full of myself. This is great. I finished shaving. I got dressed. I went to the office. I got to the office about 9 o'clock. Between 9 o'clock and 12 o'clock, the phone rang 3 times. Each time, someone had died. The members of First Methodist Church were dropping like flies. And I made my first death call, and my second, and my third. And I can remember that afternoon going back to my apartment and just hitting the bed and just saying, "God, I didn't sign up for this. I didn't have any idea what it was like to go to the cemetery. I didn't have a clue about how to preach a memorial service for one of the saints of the church. I just didn't know what to do." But over the next 3 days, there we went to the cemetery 3 different times. And here I am passing that cemetery. And the memories came flooding back. And as I did so, I thought, you know, looking back, I can see that God was preparing me for ministry. I didn't even think I wanted to preach sermons back then. And I can look back and I can say, wow, that was one of the most painful moments in my life. And yet I realized that God was preparing me for ministry. And then I started recounting all the times, I guess, I don't know, over 100 times that I've been to the cemetery since then. And sometimes with those whom I loved most. And I realized that God wasn't just preparing me for ministry. God was preparing me for life. For life. I know you all love coming here and hearing happy and joyful sermons. And this may not sound like one, but it's life, isn't it? We know that sometimes God puts us on a path in our spiritual journey that takes us to places where we do not want to go. Sometimes where we even feel alienated from God. And yet we know that sometimes God is just preparing us for life. There's this verse that came to me yesterday as I was thinking about this sermon. It's from the Old Testament, and it's one that many of you know. It's a verse that David wrote, the 23rd Psalm. He didn't always have this kind of insight, but this is the way David wrote it. He said, "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, thou art with me." He didn't say, "Yea, God, please keep me from ever having to walk through the valley of the shadow of death. He didn't say, "Dear God, please keep me from ever having to go through the wilderness." He didn't say, "Dear God, please keep me from suffering or darkness or death." He said, "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, thou art with me." And I wonder if maybe at the beginning of this season, as we contemplate what this season is about, as we grow closer to God, if that doesn't say it all. In the midst of the darkening and the darkness and the suffering, which is sometimes our spiritual journey, we nevertheless know that He is with us.